a really important thing in these things is the physics that you can get the kinetic energy by very simple relationship, half mv squared, and that kinetic energy is proportional to the temperature through Boltzmann's constant and the number of coordinates. So a key invariant of these calculations is that if you're doing an isolated system, the potential energy plus the kinetic energy shouldn't change with time. And again, that's the potential energy. This is the kinetic energy. The sum of those two things should remain constant. And there is some effect there because on computers, nothing is ever constant. And typically, the conservation is something like 1 part in 10 to the minus 10 per time step. Well, that's fine until you have a million time steps or a billion time steps. So there are problems. And typically, what one does is one connects the system to a thermal bath, either to adjust the temperature often or not. The very good thing about energy conservation that any errors in the program prevent this happening. And it's a very good external test of whether things are working. So what I'm going to talk a little bit right now is just work on thin editing liquids. And I actually do have a number of short, you know, movies to show you. So the kind of hydrogen atom of simulation is water. And the simulations done by Raman and Stillinger in 1969 and 70 were really absolutely groundbreaking. They showed that 216 water molecules in a periodic box, simulated, I think, in that case for half a picosecond, was actually enough to give you many of the properties observed to real water. And it was sort of interesting because the sociological impact of that was that a lot of models for liquid water that were much more interesting just disappeared. I think 30 years later, people are now getting back to interesting models for water, because although simulations can reproduce the properties of water very easily, we don't really understand why. So
if we put the internal structure of the water in, or just treat it as the molecules as bonds?
No, you actually, the water model is actually one looking like this, where you actually do have H2O. And the important thing is that in a simulation like this, the agreement with experiment is really very good. Now, you may be unhappy about this number, but in a box of this size, the standard deviation of the pressure is about 300 atmospheres. An atmosphere is a very small number. If you the kinds of units that we now, another really strange thing about simulation is that people use some very weird units, like kilocalories per mole, angstroms. Now, a very important thing I should also say about the box is the box needs to be periodic. Because if you took 200 water molecules, so this is basically, this is exactly a copy of this. You can actually see over here, this is just that, and this feature over here, and over here, etc. If the box is not periodic, then it won't at all behave like real water, because a little droplet, I mean, a real droplet of water with 200 water molecules doesn't behave like bulk water. But this box actually behaves like bulk water with amazing precision. Now again, the big problem here is that in a simulation, everything you calculate is subject to a random error that decreases the square root of the number of steps. And that's why computer sampling is so important, to get good numbers. And you know, experimentalists don't realize how lucky they are, because when they do an experiment on water, they won't take 200 water molecules. They'll take 10 to the 20 water molecules, maybe even 10 to the 22 water molecules. And they won't look at them for 100 picoseconds. They look at them for, you know, a million picoseconds, a whole second. So they get really, really good numbers, because when you want to measure something like a specific heat or free energy, all that averaging helps enormously. When you look at a few molecules like this, you have a real problem. So let me just...
Do you always sample the Coulomb
imagination? No, that's a very important point that you've raised. In my calculations, I've been somebody who's always tried to make the calculations go as fast as possible. And making the calculations go as fast as possible means trying to truncate these interactions at a relatively short range. So, well, so far it seems to be fine. Again, you know, there are many things which are just not okay in terms of the physics, because we know there are long-range interactions, etc. But in terms of being able to calculate experimental properties to arbitrary precision, it seems to have no effect. In fact, I even did some... You can also make some justification for it as follows. Well, there are two approaches. It's kind of a problem. If you take the Coulomb potential to all distances, you can do that theoretically using an Ewald summation. The problem with that is that it takes a system like this and it makes it into a real crystal. So now what happens is that every single water molecule sees every one of its own images out to all distances. And that isn't a normal physical system. You know, it's a super liquid crystal, if you want. Now, so that in itself is wrong. So what was done very early on, and I think it's something we do, is something called minimum image, where you will choose your range of your potential to be no more than half the box. And that way, no water ever sees its own image, because the image of this water molecule is over here. It's 16 angstroms away. But also, if it's half the box, no water even sees an image of another water which is seen by its image. And that actually, I think, so there's these two approaches. One is that we need all the Coulomb. The other is that we need a system which is going to behave like bulk water. I actually think that both of them give pretty good results right now. I would say there's no advantage, but this is much, much faster. And the Ewald summations do take longer. And remember, we're trying to push this to bigger and bigger systems to get more and more sampling.
Another question. When you say compare with experiment and calibrate, I can imagine that there would be lots that it becomes curve-fitting then.
Well, you only have three parameters. So, you know, the parameters you have are one charge, and that could be 0.4 or 0.39 or some number like that. And you actually also have a van der Waals, two Leonard-Jones of van der Waals parameters for the oxygen, an R0 and an epsilon. So you only have three parameters. And you want to fit an awful lot of information. And the information is very diverse. It's things like potential energy, diffusion constants, tumbling times, densities, etc.
How well, is there a noticeable decrease in how well it fits other properties which are not part of the...
No. And particularly, you can also fit things as a function of temperature. And in fact, if you know, in a few seconds, I'm actually going to show a much more interesting use of this to look at the hydrophobic effect. And then you'll see that there's something which was completely outside the scope of the calculation. One very important thing when you do something with these fitted parameters is to try to give the parameters as much inertia as you can, hardly ever change them. So right now, I'm still using numbers that I used in 1977, not because they're good numbers, but because I've not actually found anything which is sufficiently better to want to change them. The water numbers are maybe not as old as that, maybe 85. But again, the idea would be to keep things for as long as one can.
So what are Frank Schillinger and Strabon trying to do with water model? Were they focusing on neutron scattering data?
Well, you know, they were focusing, I think, on many of these properties. What's interesting about their water model was that their water model was too complicated. Their water model, I mean, current water models are what's called three-point models. Their model was a five-point model. They actually had lone pair orbitals. So kind of where my arrow is, they had a little negative charge on a stalk over here and another one over here. That is actually, that gives you too much directionality, and it isn't good. Let me just show you what this looks like. I didn't put the word. It'll take a second. It'll get big, don't worry. So there you actually have a box of water molecules in a simulation. Each click of this is about 1,000 time steps. So that's like 26,000 time steps. And basically, it's really hard to see anything because there's too much high-frequency motion. So a very simple trick is just to basically take out the high-frequency motion by doing a convolution, as I've done now. Now you can actually see the waters moving, and it kind of looks much more reasonable. The clock is going at the same rate, but you can see this kind of motion. And in a second, we'll see the same thing in a space-filling view. And then you really can see hydrogen bonds being formed and unformed. And you also get a nice feeling for the density of water. So the hydrogen bonds, this one's forming a hydrogen bond. And you can even follow a water molecule around if you look carefully. So that kind of gives you a pretty good view of what liquid water looks like on a picosecond timescale. A water molecule will flip over in about 20 picoseconds.
So this kind of calculation gives a good viscosity?
Yes. Well, the diffusion constant is spot on. So
diffusion constant is basically spot on.
That's a very important number to get. I think that early on people didn't worry so much about the diffusion constant, but time is an important number. So the diffusion constant is corrected within 5%.
Things like heat conductivity and all these are related.
I would imagine so, yeah.
And the charge gives you the dielectric constant,
correct? Yeah, I'm sure that, well, in terms of, if you put sodium chloride in this water, it dissolves.
So all those things are related, conductivity, yeah. Viscosity,
That's right. All the transport properties are fine. And
so except pressure.
The pressure is fine as well. The pressure. No. The pressure is. No. It's not.
No.
A box of this size. Mm-hmm. If you think about pressure, it's the collisions with the box.
Right.
You don't have enough time to get enough collisions.
I mean, the box is too small.
Okay. That's right. The averaging is. I mean, if there's just averaging, that's very bad.
I think you don't get the maximum density at 40 degrees.
Sorry, the density maximum. I don't know. We can actually do. Yeah, I think, well, the difficulty here is that in order to see that, you've got to have very long simulations. And I don't know when everyone actually had done it. I would imagine you probably do get it, but I'm not sure. You had a question?
Is he talking about freezing?
No, he's saying as water gets very cold,
right.
At 4 degrees, it has maximum density.
Right. When it freezes.
And
can you do freezing with this?
Freezing, I think, takes a very long time. So I don't know if people have done freezing. You can certainly do melting. You had a question? It does seem to be. I mean, again, this is not my work. Let me move on to something which is close to what we've done, and then it'll help indicate. So come on. Oh well, goodbye. So what I want to talk about now is a very important effect in biology, and that's the hydrophobic effect. And basically, this is an effect which has been very much studied. And the idea was to take our water model plus the structure of different hydrophobic molecules and see if we could actually calculate numbers that would be comparable with experiments, because experimentalists know a whole lot about the hydrophobic effect. It's very easy to measure the solubility of benzene in water and so on, and therefore get some idea of this. So the idea was really a very simple one. In fact, it started out with a summer student. And often when a summer student comes to biology lab, you say, make solutions. So we said to the summer student, make solutions, but these were computer solutions. And we looked at basically solutions of methane, butane, cyclohexane, and benzene. And the idea was as follows. To do a calculation where you basically take the box of water that you saw, and you put into it one methane molecule, and then you run a simulation. And then you put into that same box two methane molecules and run a simulation. Three, four, et cetera, et cetera. And then you do the same thing with one benzene, two benzenes, three benzenes. Well, it ended up, this was 5 years ago, so it took a long time to get this done, because it's a lot of calculation. I mean, I think we ended up running many microseconds of simulation to do this. And then what you want to do is just take this and, as an experimentalist, say, well, we've done this, what does it look like? So I think the best thing to do is, well, so the basic idea was to create a box like you saw before. The water molecules have become blue for no good reason. And here we actually have, I guess, 9 methanes in a box. And the key thing you want to measure is aggregation, because the hydrophobic effect is basically the fact that oily molecules like hydrocarbons segregate when they're in solution. And it turns out that actually measuring the contact between two molecules is not trivial. You might think, well, gee, you know, these two are in contact because they're close together. That ends up not working very well, and instead we had to use a Voronoi construction where essentially we basically divide space up into all these Voronoi polyhedra, and we say that solute molecule A and B are in contact if they share a face. So for example, A and B are the same distance apart as B and C, but A and B are in contact because they share a face, whereas in B and C don't share a face because this water molecule comes in and sort of steals the face. And that definition of clustering ends up being one that works. If you just simply try to clustering, numbers don't make sense. So the idea is going to be as follows. We're going to run simulations, and this just shows the periodic system, and we're going to just simply, as a function of time, record what clusters are found. Do we have clusters of 3, 5, 7, etc.? So we're going to essentially get for each run, if we put 20 methanes in the box, you know, how many clusters of 20, how many of 19, how many of 18, and we're going to average that over our whole calculation. So we're going to get these numbers for all different size clusters, and from that we're going to try to work out the free energy of forming a cluster. And that's fairly simple to do. One thing you have to worry about is that this system is periodic. And we're trying to look at clusters that are isolated. We want clusters like this. But if you have, in this case, butane molecules in a box, if you have enough of them in the box, you start to get like phase separation. So that this is exactly an image of this. You can actually see if you look at this, it's just like that. But across the box, the cluster interacts with itself. And now you get a cluster which is infinite, and that will have very different aggregation properties from a non-infinite cluster. So those are excluded from the calculation. Okay, so before I show you the movies, let me just, well, I'm not sure I have any black, but let me just say what we do. What we're going to do is I'll show you the movies of methane, butane, and benzene running for this time, just to sort of give you a feeling of what's happening. The essential calculation that is done is to look at clusters, as detected by the Voronoi calculation, and just calculate how many clusters you have. So let's just imagine that we find that we have, let's say, 60% clusters of size 10 and 20% clusters of size 9. That would imply that going from 9 to 10 is favorable because there's more 10s than there are 9s. From the numbers of those two clusters, by taking the log of the ratio, we can actually get the free energy between the two clusters. And I should have had a transparency for that. So you get a delta G is just equal to log the number of a cluster of size I divided by the number in cluster I minus 1. It's a relationship like that. And you can do it for all different concentrations and get this sort of stickiness of the clusters. So let me just go back to my movies. So I'll start off with methane. So there we have, now, one thing I should say is that you might ask, well, these aren't methanes, because where are their hydrogens? It turns out that in order to make the movies visible at all, what you need to do is do averaging. Now, if a methane molecule is rotating very rapidly, and you average its coordinates, the hydrogens will all be absorbed. So what this is really saying is that the methanes are each rotating much, much more rapidly than they're translating. And every now and again, you can see a little white thing flash by. But they're rotating so quickly that by this averaging process, you don't see the hydrogens anymore. So the methanes actually spin much more quickly than they translate. You can see the methanes translating. You can see clusters being formed. But everything is very, very transient.
Do they spin faster than water?
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I would actually think yes. I'm not sure exactly. That's right, yeah. I mean, if you like, you can still see these as Vs. So I think probably yes. Well, that's an interesting question. It'll become clearer when we look at the butane and benzene, because there you can see in certain directions, and the spinning is much more slowly. So I would guess that that actually is interesting. I hadn't thought about that. So the important thing is that this is, here you have a cluster forming and breaking apart, and it's from the concentrations of the different clusters that we can get the propensity to form associations like this. Well, it is, because I'm just, the key thing is how we're drawing this, a very important point. If we drew everything as space filling, you wouldn't actually see very much. So we've chosen to draw the water molecules just as little Vs.
Which are just the directions?
No, they're the correct size. Well, remember, they're correct size, but any averaging will make them smaller. So if they're...
They're not correct size because they are center to center. So you're missing the width of the hydrogen.
That's right. Yeah, you're missing all the extra atoms. This is just the core. So if you were to just draw... Everything is the scales right, except you have to realize that our averaging transformation, the frequency filtering we do, takes out anything that's moving very fast gets pushed towards its center. So some of the water molecules, I would imagine that the waters are about the size you're seeing them. They're just not space filling. In that one, there's definitely clustering. I mean, again, it's important to realize that the clustering is very, very transient. Although you can count it. So in this situation, if you were to say, and I would imagine here, we probably find clusters of 4 and 5 fairly predominantly. I think there's 10 methanes there. Excuse me? Yes. And that's a very important point. And let me just stop this for a second and go to here. If you remember, this was an example of a system where I had butanes in the water. And here the butane clusters are really huge compared to the size of the lattice. And you actually form these cluster-cluster interactions. That is something which we exclude. We get these. We exclude them from calculating the free energies for obvious reasons. So let me now just show you the same movie for butane. So butane is basically four carbon molecules connected together. I'm sorry, that's not butane, that's benzene. I'm going to stop it. I want to get it right. So there's butane. You can see a butane is four carbons in a row. And now you can see the butanes, the hydrogens are much more visible. So the butanes are rotating more slowly, but every now and again, the hydrogen disappear, and sometimes the butane becomes like a ball. If the butane tumbles like this, it's going to shrink to a point. Because if you average this plus this, you just get a point. And now you definitely see clustering. Again, very ephemeral. Also, you can get clusters that are formed with the neighboring molecules in the cell, and it makes it harder to see. But you can definitely get a feeling for the tumbling and for the aggregation. Here there's a very real aggregate being formed. The clusters are not labeled. The clusters are...
No, I understand. Here you have butanes labeled as different from water.
Right.
And you ask whether they come together or not. They will, of course, statistically. How do you compute whether...
What you look at is not the number of clusters of size n formed, but the relative number of, say, 9s to 8s. The idea being that, and we've seen this, that in order to make a cluster of 9, you take a cluster of 8 and add 1. And you can actually do this by following the cluster sizes. Again, if we were to draw Voronoi decompositions here, the cluster would be much clearer. It's really, these are really in a cluster. There's a cluster of 5 or 6 here, which is pretty steady. And this is pretty part of the same cluster, which is the bottom side. I think here we have a display problem. It's not easy to actually show a cluster. And I don't think that our time scale is optimum. We're showing, I think, a whole nanosecond of simulation in half a minute of runtime. But again, you definitely get a feeling that here we've formed a cluster which involves these molecules as well because of the periodic boundary conditions.
This doesn't look like the little picture of the hydrophobic effect where you grade the lattice of the...
Well, I think this is... Yeah, well, if you like, this is happening, but I guess, this is a much... I have no doubt that this, in terms of its dynamic properties, is much more realistic. The diffusion times are right, the tumbling times are right, etc. So I think it's indication that, we like static pictures. But I haven't finished. Let me just show you one more movie, which is now going to be the movie of the benzene. So now we have benzenes, you can actually see that there's six-membered rings. They're tumbling a little bit less rapidly, so although every now and again you can look here, oops, when it shrinks to a sphere, it's because it's tumbling. And now again you can see definite clustering over here. Those up there are down here clustering as well. And right now you have a single cluster. I mean, it doesn't look like a single cluster because it's broken into two halves. And you need to pan the movie to focus around here. But what's really happened is that the box is about the same size, and we basically, benzenes have six, each benzene has six carbon atoms, so a benzene is, if you like, six times more hydrophobic than methane. So these are the raw simulations. The idea is does this fit experiment? So experimentalists can measure the solvation, essentially, or the hydrophobic solubility of different size molecules. And what experimentalists have found, this has been known for a very, very long time, is that the hydrophobic interaction, as measured by solubility, of different size hydrocarbons depends on their surface area. So if you plot for a whole range of different hydrocarbons, of whether they're branched or linear or cyclic or whatever, plot their surface area, or plot the solvation energy against the surface area, you get a straight line. And furthermore, the slope of that line is about 25 little calories per square angstrom. This is a very well-known result. It has been around for at least 50 years, and it stood the test of time. Excuse me?
Yeah.
Okay. The important thing to recognize is that your point is well taken. What we did actually was to run boxes that went up one times the volume, twice the volume, four times the volume, and eight times the volume, and didn't see any effect. Also, we did see an effect in that if we have very high concentrations, then you get these aggregates that span the box, and there are problems. It looks worse than it is, because in some ways, what you really would like to do is have the movie pan to be centered on the cluster center.
Yeah,
and right now, I mean, it's very confusing, because these ones at top and the ones at the bottom are actually part of the same cluster.
But I think that in my mind, but then what came out is that when you center on the cluster,
yeah. Yeah, this is getting to the limit. Yeah. What we say is whenever a cluster actually spans the cell, it's thrown out. But, you know, I accept that, and it would be very nice to be able to run this at much higher dilutions. We can't.
Question. I remember that there was a proposal put forward by Gary Honeg in terms of the sort of curvature effect. Do you see any evidence for that?
No. I think also, well, let's just get to the results, because I was saying the box is actually as thick as you're seeing it. So you're actually projecting the entire box. You're not slicing through the box. You're projecting. So there's no doubt you're right. So that when we say that, these could be far apart. It's like looking at stars. The third dimension here is it's a cubic box. Yeah. So there's definitely a third dimension effect. The movies, you know, are an illustration rather than the numbers are the important things. So let me just, both things are interesting for different reasons. So let me just go back to, so here is the important result. And I guess I really should have had so what we find is that we can calculate a free energy change by looking at clusters and always looking at the number of cluster of size n, divide that by the number of cluster of size n minus 1, take the log of that, and that gives you the free energy of forming a cluster of that size. And the reason is that if you form a cluster of seven, it's almost always from a six. You never put a three and three together to form a seven, or three and a four together to form a seven. We've just observed that doesn't occur. So now, for every single point here, we can get a free energy of incrementing the cluster. We can also, from the geometry of the cluster, calculate the average change in surface area when you make the cluster. So typically, when you have, if you have a single isolated molecule, say one benzene and five benzenes, you put them together, there's a decrease in surface area. And in fact, the decrease in surface area approximates more or less what you'd expect from a spherical model. I don't have that shown here. But in any case, you can calculate these, and there are problems. I mean, over here, the numbers are bad, and this is at high concentrations. And it's particularly bad for butane, which is these red points, probably for the reasons you're saying about the size of the box. Butane is also long. And in fact, butane could be causing problems. So maybe our criterion for screening isn't strong enough. But we do get a sort of straight line. And the slope of the line, if you would actually put the experimental results on the same place, it would be, you know, a slope within 20 degrees of this slope. So basically, what we're finding is that this very, very simple system, which has no adjustable parameters because we're using all the parameters for the methane and the benzene come from parameterizations done in the 70s. Parameterizations for water come from things that were done maybe 15 years ago. When you combine the two, you find that there is a clustering of these molecules in water, and that the extent of clustering basically fits exactly what you'd expect from experimental measurements on solvation. So we were kind of amazed because it indicated that, by and large, the calculations are capturing a good deal about the real system. Now, can I use the board? Can this go up, or? And I can get rid of this. Okay. So typically what you're doing is I'm going to draw this schematically. Say we had a cluster. Essentially, there's a reaction. We have, say, a cluster of four plus one going to a cluster of five. Now, you've seen what the clusters really look like. So this is highly schematized. And you count how many of these you get, number of fives, the number of ones, by just averaging over the whole simulation. And then the free energy is just calculated as minus number of fives, number of fours. So you can get this number for that. At the same time, you can actually measure the average surface area of this plus this and compare it to the surface area that you get. And the surface area goes down because the total of these two will be bigger than that. So you get a delta area. And then when you plot the delta G against the delta area, you get that linear plot.
It's exactly what I'm asking. Why is there such a schematic non-experiment for molecules joined together where you saw the change of area would be quite scalar like? What gives rise to the scatter? Is that because of the different?
I think the scatter just comes from inadequate sampling. I think from not enough sampling. I mean, I think what we're assuming, we're calculating this number over the length of a simulation. And that length is only a million time steps. We're not getting a good enough averaging. Shalometer. We're not getting good enough averaging to really get good numbers. Especially, there also could be an effect of too high a concentration.
Is the scatter reproducible, or?
Maybe I should get the board back. Sorry, I get. I think the scatter is, you know, right now the problem does seem to particularly be those that have very big changes are those where you suddenly get one particular cluster type really favored. If there's a free energy change that's down here, like this point here, it means that basically the cluster that gives us very big change in surface area has a very big energy difference. And this point should have been somewhere up here. I think it's due to the fact that if you form... Well, but they also have very big areas. I think what's happening is I would imagine, we haven't looked at this carefully enough, but it's a problem because the red points are the problematic ones. There's no doubt about that. And the red points are the butane. And I think what's probably happening is that you're forming some kind of aggregate that extends across the cell in some way. And this is a structure which has a very long lifetime, certainly long on a 2 nanosecond time scale, which is a very short time. And if you, that would completely spoil your averaging, because you're assuming that the different size clusters are on equilibrium, and they may well not be.
It's interesting, though, that if you look at just the green points, and you were to ignore the blue and...
Yeah, you'd get a different ship.
Didn't it?
It would look like a... You know.
Lot, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know. My feeling actually is that, I mean, all of these curves seem to have a little bit of uplift. And the isobutylene, I mean, a smaller group, these, we need to do more simulations. I mean, for longer times, and perhaps restricting ourselves to only very low concentrations, i.e., you know, looking at things, the low concentration, I mean, these are all the high concentration runs. Excuse me? We could have. It isn't here. I mean, we need to, I would imagine that it's. I'm sure it's a lot. Although, you know, if you like, these are different runs, essentially giving. You know, I'm sure the errors are shown by these points because we have no reason to prefer this and this over that. They're all, everything is equivalent here. So, you know, in some ways, the errors here are in. You know, I think the points are really indicating the errors. We just didn't want to average data from different size molecules. And you know, I think the problem also is one of, when you get down to this small number of molecules, it's really hard to do so-called experiments. Even if you have everything you need, it's hard to get, you know, really good numbers. Without changing the temperature, we can't tell. So all we can tell right now is that we get clustering and that the magnitude of the clustering at an order of magnitude basis is exactly what you'd expect from experiment. Right. And it turns out...
Is there something that gets simulated here?
I'm sure it gets simulated. Okay. If it's real, I'm sure it got simulated. It's also very hard to tell. One of the frustrating things about a simulation... I mean, let's just go back to liquid water, which is certainly a much more solid ground than these simulations, because liquid water you really average very well. So now simulations seem to reproduce the properties of liquid water extremely well. But then you ask, well, what is it that's doing it? And the only answer is that a simple three-point water molecule with Lennard-Jones and Coulombic interactions, iterated for hundreds of thousands of times, gives you the right answer. But if you ask, well, why? And you know, you can say things, well, gee, the V-shape is very important, but it's very hard to ask why. Now, in order to see, you've got to change something. It's like doing an experiment. What we need to do is, if this is entropic, there should be a strong temperature dependence. That, and therefore, we're lucky they were able to see the effect there.
Yeah. It seems though that you know the average potential energy given as of the water as a function of the cluster size and the average kinetic energy.
I think the trouble really is that, and we could certainly try that. The difficulty is I mean, you saw the amount of motion going on there. So what you could define, for example, we've done this before, you could define water molecules that are right next to the hydrophobic surface. And then water molecules that are next to being next. And you can take averages for those subclasses. And you can get numbers, we haven't done this yet. Those numbers are always very suspect because it kind of depends on how you define your averaging. At least here we have done something which, you know, it's sort of an experimental approach. I mean, you know, you're just simply saying this is a black box, pour some water in, pour some benzenes in, run them, measure the numbers, and plot it as a very simple equilibrium experiment. My gut feeling is that, I was actually amazed that we got any, I mean, you know, this curve might look awful, but I thought that this was going to be, you know, there'd be zero correlation at all, and that the slope wouldn't even be in the ballpark. I mean, you know, the slope could have been here or there, but the fact remains that the experimental slope, I think, is like that. So that makes me feel that at least qualitatively the model captures enough to make it worthwhile going back and looking at this. The big problem is that we're meant to be interested in biological molecules and protein structures, not the physical chemistry of hydrophobic interactions. It's a whole area, it's a minefield, and you know, I could spend many, many PhDs doing this. So I guess, you know, if anyone would like to collaborate, I'd love to do it. We can generate the trajectories, that's the easy part. Analyzing them is the hard part. And
to come back to the anthropic nature, you could calculate the internal energy of this cluster and subtract it from the delta G, and that would be the anthropic.
That's true, actually, yeah. Because if the averages were good enough. Yeah, that's actually.
Well, if they are good for
but remember, yeah, but then, okay,
it
fine.
Be as good.
Yeah.
Question. I mean, the two things, one is the slope, the other is the intercept. I would expect the intercept to go through 0, 0.
Yeah. And, you know, that's, again, you know, we could have enforced it on the line and it would have, the fit wouldn't have been much worse. I mean, you can see the noise there is such that the fit would be just about as good.
Maybe it could be fine for a break.
Okay, fine.
So what fraction of your talk you went through?
I'm not going to tell you. It's classified. A very small fraction. That's okay. I'll jump to that. I mean, I'm going to just probably jump to something different.
Does the slope 25
count?
Do you when you do this density, you there's some entropic of the translation of free motion, which would change with the quite a finite size effect that might explain your.
That's true, actually. Energy. You're saying just the concentration entropy.
Yeah, because your concentration is dropping when you go to big clusters.
Then
you could cure your.
That's possible. That could be.
Of course, you cluster right into the whole system size, and then there you have much more.
So you're just simply saying the translational entry, which is one of the concentrations, there's a concentration dependence.
That depends on the cluster size.
Oh, that's interesting.
Of course, yes, and there would be a finite size correction.
That would definitely make sense. That would explain where those curves go.
That's
terrific.
And it's easy to do. You just
give me your name, so I might send you an email.
Yeah, sure. No, it's beautiful, but it's just obvious.
Oh, terrific. That's a great idea. Schnippen?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Are you here for a while?
Yeah, I'm here for all the time.
But this is, your email doesn't change.
No, this is even my email at all.
No, but, the emails don't change anymore. That's great.
You should just try it and see whether it gets better.
Yeah, no, it does seem that like each of these does have that thing.
And simply, you have to pay much more entropic cost out there because you only have
one molecule. That's very interesting. That's great. Thank you very much.
This hydrophobic effect, you see, the standard thing is essentially 0.25, that is the way.
Well, it turns out that what actually matters is how you measure the surface area. What we measure is the contact area rather than the accessible area. But if you're correct for that, it's essentially correct. Within the standard deviation, it's correct.
It was changed with temperature.
Yeah, we have.
Everybody.
We need to do that. We need to do that as well. Yeah. I'm going to have to jump. I think I will skip all this. Not directly. I mean, you know, they're very big. I mean, I think it would be very hard to. Maybe you're right. You know, you probably could. Yeah. No, you might be able to. And it's a good point. I literally, there's an awful lot of different ways. I mean, one of the problems is that we can calculate an infinite more number of things we can actually look at, and doing the calculation is the easy part.
Right.
So, and it's amazingly easy compared to doing anything else. So that's one of the big problems. That you know, it's It's a serious issue, and I don't know what the. I mean, I don't have a. You know, I'm a physicist by background, and I'm very fascinated by this stuff. But I'm working in a medical school, Department of Structural Biology.
Where are you?
I'm at Stanford. Yeah. No, for this reason, it's something which, you know, I my graduate students are biochemists and people like that. So, it's just, not always easy to basically do things like that. But you know, this is, I'm glad I gave this talk because.
There's a surface force apparatus measurement.
Yeah.
Where they see a fairly long-range dependence on the hydrophobic effect.
Well, I think the hydrophobic effect. If you convert to a macroscopic scale, what you can easily measure,
right.
You can measure things that are so far beyond the noise of any calculation.
Because it's the little things that add up to do this.
And this is why but also if you actually measure, one thing I often do is if you in these kinds of calculations, if you think about pressure, you can express it as energy per unit volume.
Right.
If you just take the thermal energy per unit volume of liquid water, mm-hmm. It's something like, I think it would translate to be like 10,000 atmospheres. So pressure is energy per unit volume.
Right. Okay.
So if you just took the thermal energy of water and divided by its volume, so water has 9 degrees of freedom, each degree of freedom has, it just turns out to be, I think it actually turns out 1 kilocalorie per cubic angstrom is 74,000 atmospheres. I'm not
you're
sure.
You're saying when you're talking these forces, which are very small.
Tiny. But they're very big for us. Because we're used to the fact we have Avogadro's number all around us. So wherever we see anything, it's been averaged very, very well. So you can measure things that might be 1/10,000th of thermal energy per unit volume easily. Easily, 1 atmosphere, even less, maybe 1 millionth. So for calculations to get there, it'll be very difficult.
But you can ask questions about if there's...
No, I'm sure you can, by being clever you can. It's tiny, the effect is minuscule.
Yeah, this is where you're...
I'm saying that effect is tiny.
The pressure difference is...
The noise in the system would completely obliterate any ability to see that.
Right. You say it's a tiny difference of huge numbers. So it's extremely hard to measure. Yeah. It's extremely hard to calculate.
It's kind of frustrating because there's a complementarity here. Simulations are really good for giving you detail.
Yeah.
Like those pictures. But if you want numbers, experiment is much, much better because experiment can look at many molecules and average. It'd be great if we could. Wouldn't it be nice to average for a microsecond? That would be amazing.
So you're saying that if you want to ask questions like, you have this difference in pressures in these balls because of their proximity, and it's due to something.
It's much more safe using theoretical. I think what you need for that is an analytical approach where you can fit the analytical approach on what you can calculate and then extrapolate after very long.
But the thing here is that you're saying that these differences in structuring, they'd be very subtle then.
And you've got this very high background of water thermal energy.
No, it's...
I mean, one of the things about this is that...
I think
if an experimentalist has 10 to the 20 or 10 to the 20 more molecules and 10 to the 10 more time, his standard deviations will be 10 to the 15 smaller.
His what?
Standard deviation. So that's a lot. And
I understand the fundamental difficulty of getting at that type of question.
But I think that people are getting very clever, and there are lots of interesting ways. And I think that oftentimes trying to do something opens up all sorts of interesting avenues that you wouldn't think about.
This is something that's been a question that's been interesting for quite some time, and I'm always doing other things too.
Yeah.
I have time to address it.
But I have just a question as an outsider in this field. I hear talks occasionally, and I was on a PhD thesis committee and things like that, where someone comes along and says, hey, we now have a better model for water. And they say, look, if you look at the old models for water, they get the hair distance correlation function wrong. And what we really need is polarizability, or you really need... And so as an outsider, I'm trying to reconcile...
I think it depends. If you want a water model that will work for all the phases of water. Mm-hmm. You know, isolated water molecule. For example, the water molecule that I use has too big a dipole moment because it's kind of included some of the polarizability. Then, if you kind of would like a water molecule with the same molecule, would work great for ice, for vapor, for liquid water, then I don't think you can do it with a simple pairwise additive model. But so people have, but the trouble right now is that the polarizable models are at least an order of magnitude slower. Mm-hmm. So therefore, their standard deviations are a factor of three too big. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, I think we're really fighting the statistical problem, the noise problem. And it's so we can get away from that. I mean, I think that, I'm not saying this is the last word in water models.
But maybe, you're saying that
you know, another, tenth that's, another tenth of the sixth in computer power, and we'll be worrying about all of these things. But, mm-hmm. you know, we're not there yet. Well, see, one way you could also argue this is that most people who are doing, you know, reasonable size calculations are still using very, very simple water models. Although, no one has done...
Wait, but you still have a problem where when you start talking about these large systems,
that's right.
These details start to have very real effects.
That's right.
This is the kind of point you make.
No, we can't even approach those large systems. Anything, you know, that's interesting and macroscopic. And, you know,
it even occurs in a small system. Where
I mean, like, you know, people ask me about the water density maximum. Well, if the water density maximum occurred at 20 degrees centigrade, I'd be thrilled. It won't be 4. I mean, it doesn't have to occur at 4.18, whatever it occurs at. Because
the tip gives it around 15 or something.
Yeah, which is fine. Mm-hmm. I'm sure this is very similar. It's not that different.
What gets it at 15?
There's a tip of 3.2 water model, which is similar to this one. There are small differences. Some people keep their waters actually fixed. They don't let the waters vibrate.
You mean the angle?
Yeah.
And then these, they can?
They actually can vibrate. But I honestly don't think that's a big deal. Yeah. I really think that they will basically capture the physics more or less, and that seems to be enough.
And certainly you're saying the physics would then... Your noise limit.
Yeah. And it's definitely
that's your fundamental.
But you could ask that at this stage, what you would really want to do is to have an accurate model that captures the reality at the situations we're simulating, and the idea of having a universal model that would work in
and I think, you know, all of this is curve theory. I mean, the real model is quantum mechanical. And people actually, what's interesting, people have now been able to do quantum mechanical calculations on water, densely functional, with 64 water molecules for about a picosecond. And they also behave very well. I mean, they kind of fit, you know, but they haven't made any new phenomena. And that's kind of amazing to me because that's a much bigger, you know.
Not about this proton transfer that looked like.
Yeah, but how, you know, how much, even, you know, what, you know, say you have a pH of 7.
Yeah,
that's one proton in 10 to the 7.
Yeah.
Now you have 200 molecules. You know, one in every 10 to the 5. Time sets the problem will appear. Maybe, you know, I think we will get there. But I think right now, I think one of the key things in all of this stuff is to choose that subset of things that allow the calculation to be done, but keep enough of the reality. You know, you always know you're treading on very thin ice, and it's the nature of the game. So you sat down and you said, we're going to do this properly. You couldn't do anything.
I think of Einstein, you know, the secret is to make the system as simple as possible, but no simpler.
And I'm all the time, I mean, in some ways, I'm continually expecting to be caught. Now, you try to get a, you know, you, what you really want to do is for the ice to break. No. For example, early on, people used to leave out the hydrogen atoms on things like methane and butane and things like that. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't work. So, you know, there are things you have to be very careful about. Can I just start?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So I guess, and I really enjoyed that first part because I got a lot of suggestions and it was fun talking about that. I think I prepared more material by about a factor of 6, so I'm going to jump to something different. This is fine. I mean, I've just been teaching a class and making 17 new PowerPoint slides a week has basically destroyed my life because I'm getting good at it now, but it's really a drag. It's much easier to use transparencies, but I think so. What I want to talk now about is forgetting aside all the physics, just talk about predicting structures of proteins. So this is a field that's getting an awful lot of attention, and let's just see what we can do. Actually, I'm going to skip over this because that's not that interesting. Let's just talk about algorithmic folding. So the idea is, can we predict the structure of a protein without really worrying about how the molecule folds up. So why might this be possible? So here is an unfolded protein chain. And this molecule will spontaneously fold up into an object like this. And what I'm trying to point out is that although we have 20 different amino acids along the chain, they sort of fall into two classes. They're the hydrophobic ones, you know, hydrophobicity is now the nonpolar ones, and the hydrophilic ones. And when the thing folds up, the hydrophobic ones go into the middle, and the hydrophilic ones go into the outside. And as a very general rule, when you actually look at the three-dimensional structure of a protein in its atomic detail, it's a very beautifully constructed structure. All the details just look really, really good. And one gets the feeling that perhaps if you were shown the correctly folded structure of a protein, you could recognize it. So, in fact, let me just skip forward for a second. So this leads to a sort of general paradigm for structure prediction, where you try to break the thing up into two steps. So what you're trying to do is generate these chains. These chains actually have lots of detail, because a protein structure does consist of a great deal of detail. In fact, let me just think. Maybe I'll show you, I'm jumping too far. Let me just show you a couple of illustrations of exactly some different views of a protein. And then we'll come back to this, because this can be helpful. So, here's a cartoon of protein folding, which actually helps illustrate the So that is a good view of a small protein. So it's a really large, complicated three-dimensional object. This is the protein bovine pancreatic trypsin inhibitor. It's got 58 amino acid residues and almost 1,000 atoms. And this is just a computer cartoon of the molecule unfolding. Essentially, I'm just pulling one end, and it's coming apart. It actually went off the screen. And now you're going to see protein folding. This is a total cartoon. Just to give you some idea of the nature of the process, so you have a chunky chain that's quite thick, having to form a very, very compact globule. So once again.
You're pulling it with force.
In this case, it's just, I mean, this was done a long time ago. This is just a morphing experiment. I mean, there's nothing is being pulled. So the key thing is just to give you a sort of feeling for the three-dimensionality of it, the packing. Things, I mean, everything is interacting with water, and I've left that out right now, but you're getting this very intricate packing of the structure. Yeah, this could be pulled out by force, but actually, if you notice, this part is, as it pulls up, this piece is fixed. So it's just a, it's actually a very old film clip. No, actually, the colors are different. It turns out the coloring is the reds and the blues are oxygen and nitrogen, and the grays are carbon. So, anyway, okay. This is actually a very, one of the fun things I discovered is how to convert video to MPEG and then to edit MPEG. So this actually comes from a bit of video that was made about 20 years ago. So it was more for my nostalgia than for anything else. But it does help illustrate exactly what the process looks like. So the idea is basically the follows. Let's imagine we want to predict structures, and we want to do it by a fairly general paradigm. The idea would be, and one way you could predict the structure would be to set up an energy function like I showed you in the first part of the talk, enough computer time, and run a simulation to make things fold up. The trouble is that proteins fold up in something like, at the very quickest, 1 millisecond. And that corresponds to 10 to the 12 time steps, so that would be maybe 10 to the 6 days of computer time. It isn't as bad as it seems, because if BlueGene is built, perhaps 10 to the 6 days will become 1 day. And a colleague at Stanford, Vijay Panda, has a very nice idea called folding at home, where he's sort of worked out how to parallelize protein folding in a nice way. And he basically uses people's machines as a screensaver. So basically, his program is now competing with SETI at home. And he's got, I think, 15,000 machines around the world that are trying to fold up proteins. And what he does that's very clever is that the machines essentially explore the space. When one particular protein goes over a barrier, it essentially calls up all the other ones and says, I've gone over a barrier, come to me. And it knows it's gone over a barrier by the fluctuation in the potential energy. But we're putting that aside. Even there, it looks like things are too slow by some enormous factor. So the idea is, can we sort of forget all the physics and try to predict structures by an algorithmic approach? And the algorithmic approach has two steps. One is, we need to be able to discriminate. Okay, one is to make a set of all possible shapes. Now, it turns out that that's impossible because the number of shapes is probably 10 to the 100 or something like that. But let's say you assume that. So now you make all these different shapes, and each one is a different plausible shape for a protein, maybe putting the hydrophobics on the inside and the hydrophilics on the outside, maybe not, built by some set of rules. And then you have some magic discrimination function that looks at each of these in turn, and on one of them, you know, the bulb goes off. The red light bulb lights up, and it says, okay, this is the right structure. It just looks right. Now, the advantage of doing things this way is it actually has a number of advantages. One is, the energy function that is used for discrimination doesn't have to be a function that you could actually do a simulation with. It doesn't have to be a differentiable potential energy. It could just be, gee, I like that. It could be a totally non-differentiable function that you can just calculate like that. The other thing is that to think about doing this in one step, where you have to basically go from an open chain to a folded chain using the energy function, is very daunting. Writing a program that will make many decoys is a manageable task, and equally well, writing a program that will discriminate them is also fairly manageable. Also, there's a very interesting sort of dynamic here, in the sense that the discrimination task, the ease of the discrimination, depends very much on how good the decoys are. So if somebody, go ahead.
But you have to make sure the native state is in the decoy.
Well, there's two things you can do. If you're testing this, you can put the native state in there. So you're making a haystack, put the needle in there. You're right, in reality, that's a problem. So, but I think the key thing here is that, let's imagine that the people making these make awful looking structures. Every one of them just doesn't look at all like a protein. Then you put the protein in there, anyone can recognize the right one. If they make structures which are very protein-like, that will help fool the discrimination people. So there's a nice dynamic where half the group tries to make decoys, and they're trying to make decoys that are going to fool the discriminators. They do that by making decoys that look more and more and more protein-like. The discriminators have to be able to distinguish real protein from sort of protein-like. So there's an interesting dynamic. Okay. So, let's get over that. Now, one thing I should say is an energy function that is often used in these tests are the so-called knowledge-based energies, or people call them potentials of mean force, other terms. And this is just a statistical potential where you just count how often something occurs in your desired state. Say we ask how often green spheres occur next to each other. And then we shuffle all the labels. We count how often they occur in a random state. And if n is the number of times they occur in the ordered state and m in the random state, we just take the log of the odds, so the log of the ratio, to give a so-called energy. All this really is a score which is additive. It's a probability score. Take the log to make it additive. And people sometimes multiply this by kt, although it doesn't really make any difference. It's only a score function. And the absolute scale is totally irrelevant. In more detail, you can actually do this for residues, for atoms, for helices, for anything you want, and basically get quite nice looking curves. The great thing for doing this is that we now have the X-ray structures of something like 2,000 different proteins, depending on how you define different, so that you can measure very, very large numbers of distances. For example, if you find for a particular distance that there are many at a certain distance, and then it goes down again, this would imply that the energy function had a minimum over here. If it looked like this, it might be a purely repulsive energy function, or else neutral. So from these distributions, you can get these functions. And these functions have actually been really quite good at discriminating a folded from a non-folded structure. So
are we going to discriminate structures which look like those which are in your database
right.
with the others? So you will not be able to find new structures?
Well, you don't know about that. The idea is how, I mean...
Because there is some underlying bias in the...
There's underlying bias, certainly, but the hope is that this particular formulation, you try to choose a formulation which is fairly generalized. And that's a very important point, because it brings me on to exactly the next thing. How do you test these things? So a key sort of discovery that was due to John Moult in 1993 was to basically change the way you predict structures by really predicting what you don't know. And this might sound really revolutionary, but in an awful lot of science, you try to fit things that you do know the answer to. But when it comes to protein structure prediction, you really would like to predict things that you don't know the answer to. And he organized a very complicated scheme where any year crystallographers and NMR spectroscopists would be working on a certain protein. Those sequences would be made available to the community. The community would work on predicting them. And then by a certain deadline, all the predictions would be collected. They would be evaluated. Then it would be judged to see who did best. And then we would meet to do this. And now there have actually been four of these individual CASP meetings. So basically, they're every 2 years. The first one was in 1994, and they've been 94, 96, 98, and last year. And something like 40 different sequences are released to the community. Unfortunately, they're not released very evenly. So you usually get one in May, and two in June, and five in July, and 33 in August, and the deadline is the end of August, so this has a very bad effect on one summer holiday. And the idea is that large numbers of groups work together to predict these structures and then send them in. At the most recent CASP that was actually held just a few months ago in the Asilomar in December, there were, I think, typically for any particular one of the sequences, between 100 and 115 different groups participating, and each group might submit large numbers of different predictions. So the idea is then to sort of see who does best. And this actually is very interesting. It's interesting as a competitor because you have real deadlines. In most of our science, the only deadlines we really have are to get the proofs back and to get the grants in. No one sort of tells you, well, if you don't do this bit of work by next Wednesday, forget it. We don't care. We never want to see it. No one's interested. Just throw it away. But with CASP, it's like that. If you're working on a certain molecule and the deadline is a certain time, the deadlines are usually midnight Pacific time, so you often miss dinner and lunch and cause all sorts of family strains. Basically, you have to do it. The other thing is that in the lab, what really matters is not, you know, how fast my program is theoretically, but how much I can get done today. It's a very different issue. And there are different approaches to whether you, in a particular lab, collaborate or compete. There's definitely a competitive aspect here. But the good thing is that everyone believes that no one can cheat. This is a completely double-blind experiment. The people who do well are obviously doing something right. So that background, what I really want to do is describe some of our work. We are not the best people at this. We're one of the good groups. But we've actually looked at a number of different... What's interesting here is one of the key things are the different ways of representing the molecule geometrically and the different methods to be used. And we actually generally try to use a large number of different methods to sort of get some kind of different approach. So a very early method was one which said, OK, let's really go for the exhaustive enumeration outlined over here. Just really try to make all the possible shapes. Now, to do that, you have to use a very simple model. And the model we came up with was just a lattice walk like this, a self-avoiding lattice walk. But we even went further. We said, OK, we will do a walk not on a square lattice, but on a tetrahedral lattice, because that is, in three dimensions, the lattice that has the smallest complexity. There are only three ways of joining on the chain. And then we even went one step further and said, we will actually, if our protein is length n, we will only use half of n lattice points for this. The idea basically being that we want to make this an exhaustive enumeration, and we could tolerate about 100 million different shapes, but not more. So with this method, it turns out you can actually fit a real protein to about 5 angstrom units. A typical scale here is that this distance between adjacent residues. So we're leaving out all the atoms. We just got is about 4 angstroms. So 5 angstroms is, you know, maybe this big on that scale.
Just to make sure I understand what you're doing, you have a tetrahedral lattice like these, and you try to keep the backbone as best that you can.
No. We try to generate all possible shapes on that lattice. Okay. Then we try to ask which one looks most like the real answer. And the answer is 5 angstroms. That isn't terribly good. That's the best you can do with this lattice. And the question is it good enough to get some discrimination? So now what we're really saying is that our bag of structures has nothing which is better than 5 angstroms. But with a 5-angstrom set, can you still discriminate between good and bad? So it's a different kind of question. And using a discrimination function like this, we see the following. It's a little bit complicated. So remember, you have 10 million or 100 million structures, depending on the chain length. And the set of structures that you get only depends on the chain length, because there's nothing, you're doing an exhaustive enumeration. Not only that, but if you change the chain length by 1, there'll be an enormous overlap in the structures. You'll basically add, you know, there'll be 9 more at each end or something like that for each structure. So what you can do is you can take all your structures shown here by the blue line. Also, the structures are generated in such a way, like on the chessboard, the structures are bounded. You don't have any very long structures. They've got to fit into a certain volume. The volume that we actually use is exactly the same for all proteins. It happens to be a 50-lattice symmetrical object, a 50-vertex symmetrical object carved out of a lattice. By making it symmetrical, the exhaustive enumeration is much easier, because you only have to start out from each of the asymmetrical points. So what you find is, here are the set of structures, and some of these structures are quite good. Unfortunately, there are 2 different deviation measures, and there's a distance deviation and a coordinate deviation, and I've actually mixed them up. So when I said 5 angstroms, I mean coordinate deviation, and that corresponds to about 3 angstroms in distance deviation. Too bad. But basically, what you do is you have 1 million or 10 million structures under this envelope. This is on a linear scale, so there's some very long tails not shown. We take all those structures, and we calculate the energy using a very simple statistical energy function like that. And then we take the subset of the 10 million that have the lowest energy. And then we plot their distribution. And all those structures have moved to be closer to the structure we're trying to predict. Now, why did that happen? This set will be the same for any length. There is no sequence information. As soon as you put the energy on, you have sequence information. And because the interaction of the green spheres will be different from the interaction of the blue spheres, etc. So we get that, and this has moved in that direction, which is kind of encouraging. It's saying even though these models are very, very low resolution, we're still getting a push in this direction. Now, I guess this is kind of pretty, but we would like to see a control. And I think that theoreticians need to do much more controls. I think what we can really learn from biologists is that controls are really a good idea. Calculate something when you know what the answer should be, because you may be surprised. So the idea would be, what is pushing this in this direction? It's obviously the fact that we're using the sequence, the amino acid sequence, that corresponds to the protein here at 0 deviation, the correct protein. So let's do exactly the same calculation with a shuffled sequence. Keep the same composition, but just shuffle the sequence. What you get is that. So now the blue curve is exactly the same. But now the low energy subset with the wrong sequence has no tendency to be closer to this, because it's not the sequence of the structure. So that was a very nice control. There are a few things about these curves that kind of puzzle me, and maybe someone will have an interesting idea. I was very surprised that the subset of only 1,000 structures, that distribution looks so similar in shape to this distribution. It's just shifted. So some of the low energy structures are very good. They have low deviations. Others are quite bad. I cannot understand at all why a subset of 1,000 out of 10 million, which is a tiny percentage, should have the same shape. And it's an approximate Gaussian, but you know, the central limit theorem doesn't really apply, because you're choosing a subset. I can expect it to be a Gaussian, but why should it have such similar width? I don't know whether there's anything profound here or not. But people I've told this to have said, oh, it's obvious. Other people have said, we don't understand. I certainly don't understand it at all. If anyone has any good ideas, that would be great. So this method actually was used at the CASP meeting in 98, and was used as follows. It's kind of complicated. What we did is we took each of the sequences and generated walks for them. And you have 10 million walks. We would choose a subset of 10,000 out of the 10 million. For each of those, we would add all the atoms. And there's a technique where you can add all the atoms back to the chain. And then we would calculate the energy and combine them in different ways to end up with a final prediction. We'd then submit that. And these are some of our better results. And these results, I'm just showing them because kind of indicate just how bad things can be. So for example, for this particular protein, we managed, you can't read the numbers, we managed to fit 60 residues to about 7 angstroms. And just showing it, this is the X-ray structure, looking like that. And this is the prediction.
So that's 60 residues?
That's 60 residues. Okay. One of the things that they do at CASP, to be nice to people, is that they let you, they choose for you the best matching contiguous piece. And that makes it a lot easier. But they do this for everybody. Here's a case where we did 46 residues to the same 7 angstroms. It's an interesting case because here the actual X-ray structure, this protein has lots of helix. This is helical structure. And I haven't really had a chance to explain secondary structure to you. But this protein actually has these hairpins. The chain folds back on itself, folds back on itself, and folds back on itself. It actually has 3 hairpins. And the prediction also had that same structure. One hairpin, another one, and another one. So superficially, some of these actually look fairly good. But that was the results as they were 3 years ago.
When you add all the atoms, the background, you still fit the background. You don't change the background.
You try to fit the background as much as you can. You actually fit, we do a relax it. Initially, we fit it exactly, and then we relax it.
Relax the background.
Yeah.
So and when you discovered that you're confident about the 3 hairpins, did you say, well, maybe I should optimize the packing further by getting the densest score or something?
Well, one of the troubles with CASP is that you have no time to think. And afterwards, you're exhausted and you don't want to see them again. So I think that this is, I mean, you know, it's a different way of doing science. And one of the troubles is that there's a little bit of a gambling instinct. If you have a new idea, you try to quickly throw it in at the end, hoping that it's going to, but it usually doesn't work. So, you know, instead of very carefully testing all your ideas and then using them, you kind of get sometimes a little careless. But we were encouraged by this, and this was kind of the indication of the quality that people were getting. The best people, the top 6 groups, were getting about 3 years ago. Let me just indicate, well, 2 years ago. Let me indicate where things are more now. So here is one method that actually uses a different technique. And this is a method that was worked on by Henke Sa, who moved into a faculty position at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel. And his idea was the following. Let's look at real proteins and see what kinds of hydrogen bonds are formed in real proteins. Now, in real proteins, you have helices, these kinds of wiggly things, but you also have beta strands. And you get different kinds of beta strands. Here's, this is not really very clear, and I have much better pictures of this, but you get cases where the chains run parallel to each other, and there are hydrogen bonds all along, or when they run anti-parallel, and there are hydrogen bonds all along, but you don't get funny mixtures. The hydrogen bonding patterns occur in a fairly regular way. So he basically added to the energy function terms that would greatly reward having good hydrogen bonds and greatly disincentivize things having bad hydrogen bonds. The energy function was no longer physical. It didn't have any water there. It was going to be used for minimization. But it had some very clever ways of allowing for cooperativity. So basically, if you formed 2 good hydrogen bonds, you got a bonus score that was much more than if you formed 2 non-connected hydrogen bonds. If you would form 2 adjacent hydrogen bonds, like say this one and this one, in the same sheet, you'd get extra points that if you formed this one and one like this, you'd lose points for that. And when you did this, and this becomes a minimization, and the way we sampled, we couldn't do this exhaustively, was to start out with random initial points, minimize from each of them, and the minimization was done by varying not the Cartesian coordinates, but the torsion angle coordinates of each of the structures. And when you did this, basically you get a whole lot of structures, and then you have to choose one that you're going to submit. This is the hard part. And in fact, for these ab initio situations where you don't use any sequence method similarities, you're allowed to submit 5 predictions, and they choose the best of your 5. So they kind of try to get this. Now, it turned out that the best one we submitted was actually at 5 angstroms. It kind of captures a fair amount of this. The best one we actually had in our set of 20,000, we didn't submit it, was at 3 angstroms. So again, we're generating a good ensemble, but we're not picking the right structure. And a lot of work needs to be done more on that. I think the best prediction that was actually submitted for this was, I think, a 3.7 angstroms. So somebody did, I think this was the third best prediction. Another case was, this one we felt quite pleased about. This was a protein where the X-ray structure has all these beta strands. So here we see these chains where the chain is basically running parallel or anti-parallel and forming hydrogen bonds like this. This was the X-ray structure. This was a prediction. And it's somewhat similar. In detail, it's capturing a fair amount of what's going on. We've also tried, someone else in my group, Ram Samudrala, who's now a faculty member at the University of Washington in Seattle, his approach was to actually use Monte Carlo rather than minimization by changing the torsion angles. He basically minimized the structure to fit this knowledge-based function, where in fact it was a very complicated knowledge-based function because he collected statistics on every different kind of atom. The atoms in proteins are labeled C alpha, C beta, and so on, depending on how they are. And he said that a C alpha atom from valine was different from a C alpha atom from leucine. People would always treat these as the same. He decided that they were different, meaning 165 different kinds of atoms, but the statistics are there, you can collect the data. So then what he did is he basically used this Monte Carlo method to try and get this to fold up, and he got a very good prediction where for this particular case, what usually happens is if the predictions are not so good, you draw them side by side. If they're very good, you superimpose them. And in this case, he got a fit of 80 residues for 4 angstroms, and you know, one of these is the X-ray, one of these is the prediction. The coloring is such that you go from blue through the rainbow to red. The reason is that the N-terminus is a nitrogen, that's blue. The C-terminus is a carbon, that's red. This is actually a convention in all the programs. I didn't actually realize why it was until I had to teach about this. But it kind of gives you a feeling of the spectrum. And similar colors are similar to each other, and this one did particularly well. Okay, I'll leave it aside. We've also had another method which we've also been using where we try to scientists approach the whole thing not from the point of view of a chain, but from the point of view of assembling secondary structures. And you can actually use minimum spanning trees to exhaustively enumerate all the different ways of packing together these pieces. And then later you connect up all the edges as chains. This method, we tested it at CASP4 in preliminary form. It didn't do very well. But often that, I think, may have been the fact that one of the things that we did in our lab, which, you know, we wanted to use this as a way to learn what methods were good and what methods were bad. So we ended up testing 5 different methods. And it was interesting. Some things were interesting. The method that we actually did well on 2 years ago came like 25th out of 100 this year. So people are getting much, much better. These other methods were in positions 3 or 4 this year. They weren't the best ones. Okay, I'm going to skip over bioinformatics. There isn't time for this. I think what I'm going to do just to end is just say a few things. Yeah, just in conclusion, so my lab basically has these different parts, physical simulation, prediction, and bioinformatics. We're a fairly small, well, I guess 10 people is actually quite a large group nowadays. We have very little space. We only have about 800 square feet, so it's kind of crowded. People are encouraged not to come in and telecommute and work from home, which is actually fine. We have a computing environment. We've been using Linux on commodity boxes since 1996. We now have something like 120 CPUs. We haven't, a Beowulf cluster, which is the way to go, involves everything being the same. And we can never do that. We always buy machines when we have money left over. And we tend to buy machines that are not rack mounted so we can actually give them to secretaries and they become out of date. So the desktop machines are last generation. The ones we give to the secretaries are two generations ago and so on. But it means you can basically buy machines at the very cheapest prices. And we do that. We typically use a Red Hat Linux, Fortran, F2C, C and Perl, some C++. It's really important to keep people happy. So laptops, they all have laptops and DSL lines at home and desktops at home because this keeps them very productive. Most of the work is embarrassingly parallel. We don't need very large machines. We need lots of computer time. But if you think about evaluating folding and you're starting out from 60,000 random positions, each of those are totally independent. If you had 60,000 machines, you could do it. Even the simulations can be doing it. And again, I've become pretty good at Windows because it's a great way to impress friends and family. I just want to acknowledge various members of the group. We have funding from NIH, DOE, and NSF, and lots of stuff on websites. And thank you all for your attention.
For this lattice model, you had another lattice model, which used your M state model.
Yeah.
Why don't you use that model?
Well, what we found actually, we actually are working on that. Sorry.
Why that particular lattice?
Sorry, give me a second. I'll get back to it. I actually had a slide that I skipped over, which is exactly the one. Although I use PowerPoint, I make JPEGs at the end because I hate the delay of PowerPoint. So basically, we had a model before, which I don't really describe here, where it was an off-lattice model where every residue had four states. We've now generalized that in a different way. What we've done is we've done, this is very, very new work done by Rachel Kolodny, new PhD student. What she's done is she's taken small fragments of proteins and clustered them using some very, it turns out that clustering methods don't work, so she had to use some pretty clever clustering methods. Now what she does is she takes a protein and fits it by overlapping clusters. And this actually gives you a very, it becomes alphabetic now because one piece follows another piece in a fixed way. And now you can have a discrete state situation where your variables are the pieces that you use. And we're just testing that model. That model seems to be, fits proteins significantly better. Before we had a four-state model, where every residue had four states, and you could fit proteins to about two angstroms. The lattice model that I showed you here, this lattice model has three states for every two residues. So it has square root of three states per residue, 1.7 states per residue. That fits proteins to about five angstroms. But the fragments, using this, something like four states, Rachel can fit proteins to about 1.5 angstroms. Well, she's using a fragment, it's complicated. She has 20 different kinds of fragments for every two residues. So it's a square root of 20, 4.4, whatever the number is, states per residue. She can fit things to 1.5 angstroms. You want to be able to fit proteins as well as possible. So we're playing with this model, and it looks very promising. So that's where we are with that. It's the other thing, I guess, we've become, I mean, this is sort of embarrassing, but I finally discovered Monte Carlo. I mean, it took me, having been brought up with minimization and worrying about continuity, I discovered Monte Carlo just a few months ago. And I love it. I mean, it's just amazing what you can do. And it's so terrific. If you have an idea of a potential function, you can program it like in no time. Now we're doing more and more Monte Carlo sampling. And in fact, it's more related to this. But this is not really enumeration, it's Monte Carlo sampling from different, I mean, typically what we're doing now, the enumeration is fine, you can't really enumerate exhaustively for any model. But we found that either by a minimization approach from random starting points or a Monte Carlo approach from random starting points, you get sampling which is pretty good in that the right answer is often in there. When, if here you superimpose them, I mean, this is the X-ray, I guess this one is prediction at 3.3. We had one like that. We predicted one like that. We just couldn't tell it apart. So I think right now, using either Monte Carlo or minimization. And Monte Carlo is actually even faster. I think right now I can do this in about 15 seconds. I can do 50,000, I think I can do 100,000 Monte Carlo steps a minute on my laptop. With Monte Carlo is also fun because you can really get clever about how to make things go really fast. And the question is now how you distinguish good from bad. And that's, so right now I would say that even going back further in this whole scheme of things, we're quite good at generating sets of decoys. Even as by Monte Carlo sampling, discrimination has become a problem again. Well, no, we did choose, okay. It turns out that methods for predicting secondary structure, i.e. predicting whether a region is helical or strand or nothing, have actually improved quite a lot. And right now they're about 80% accurate. So using those, you kind of can get the secondary structure and get the segments. I think that was just done by, and the reason it didn't work out so well is that the person who did it completely by himself. He has not been in this field for a very long time. I don't think he was sufficiently experienced. I mean, I think the shock of suddenly being told, you better do this by tonight because otherwise you're wasting everyone's time, you know, it takes a while to get into that philosophy. I mean, it's really, this is guerrilla science in the worst, in the best sense of the word. So I don't think it's been explored sufficiently well. I still think that the idea of fitting together, because they definitely have preferred pieces, and I think that we're not clear now whether we got these wrong. See, there's again, we haven't even checked the following thing. Did we have better structures? You always submit 5 out of 50,000. Among our 50,000, were there some really good ones? That hasn't even been looked at yet. These need to be looked at. A lot of work to be done. Thank you.